I was not in the room for that, so if y'all were a bit confused, that's why. Anywho, this has been a fun hour of chaos with y'all, but it is just about 5 o'clock, so I must bid you all farewell until next week. So Living Writers is up next. Hope y'all have a wonderful afternoon and a wonderful rest of the week. Thanks. See you later.
Power 99 with hours of commercials and giveaways every 15 minutes. And now back to more music and the $1 million giveaway.
What are you listening to?
Oh, I don't know, some radio station. Does it matter? I thought all radio stations were alike.
Oh no, Potsy, not all radio stations are alike. There's one called WCBN that's different.
Really?
Yes, WCBN will keep you interested in life, providing an ever-changing perspective of music and ideas. With hours of freeform, hours of jazz, and hours of specialty programming and news every day. Why, WCBN is a veritable cornucopia of ideas. So, change your dial to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. It will change your life.
Gee.
Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm so glad you've tuned in today. Ellen Muehlberger is here in the studio. Her latest book out with Oxford University Press, hot off the press, The Spring, Moment of Reckoning, Imagine Death and Its Consequences in Late Ancient Christianity. Ellen, welcome back.
Welcome to me, and hi. It's back to being. It's nice to be back
to
here.
Listeners, and
that's right. That's right.
So we were just talking right before we went on air. The last your first book, our last time in the studio together, was 2013, right?
And 6 years ago.
And it's so great now to have you here with the new book.
Thank you for the repeat invitation. It's fantastic.
It's open anytime.
I'm ready. And
ready for the next. Maybe we get to the project because I know you're working on something else now.
Right.
You've
we may talk about that.
In the works.
Yeah.
Okay. But today, it's the day for Moment of Reckoning. So hold on to your seats.
That sounds ominous.
Yeah, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Doesn't it? Well, and then the subtitle, Imagine Death and Its Consequences in Late Ancient Christianity. I mean, It's kind of setting us up for an interesting hour.
It's a dark book, I will say. And I'll say it was dark to work on, and I'm kind of ready to be, you know, working on puffier topics.
And how long was this in the making, Ellen? Was it a decade, or what was the...
The first couple of times that I thought about it and thought about what sources I might want to write about and what kinds of things I might want to say was probably 2008 or 2009. So yeah, I think a decade.
And that's when you were thinking, what's next on deck? What idea do I want to reckon with? Okay, I won't keep using the word reckon, I promise.
You know, I think every time that you're working on a project, there's always the back burner where things are bubbling and or seeming sometimes more interesting than the actual work that you have in front of you that needs to get done. So this was something that was on the back burner when I was finishing my dissertation, the draft that ended up becoming that first book. And it was just, it's always nice, I think, to have a second train of thought going because it allows you to distract yourself a little bit from the taskiness of the thing that's in front of you. And having this as a project, you know, eventually it becomes the thing that you have to do and all the taskiness transfers to that new project. But this was, for a long time, it was something that I could just think about off in the corner when I wanted to distract myself from the things in front of me or when I was bored with the things in front of me.
From the angels.
Yeah. Right.
Well, before we go any further, I'll just read the short bio in the back of Moment of Reckoning. Hashtag Moment of Reckoning, everyone out there. Okay. Ellen Muehlberger is Associate Professor of Christianity and Late Antiquity in the Departments of Near Eastern Studies and History at the University of Michigan. During the research for this book, she held of the Charles A. Riskempf Research Fellowship and a National Endowment for the Humanities Fellowship. Ellen lives in Ann Arbor.
Indeed.
No, I just added that last part, informally, and we'll fill in more parts of the story as we go. But you mentioned that this is Moment of Reckoning is a dark book and that it was intense in the writing of it.
It was. I was often thinking about how ancient people anticipated their own deaths. And what I discovered in the research was that frequently they were being taught to anticipate their deaths in very dark and terrifying ways. So there was a lot of my own imagining of what it would have been like to get taught to think about one's life and the end of one's life in these terms. And it just wasn't the most uplifting topic, but it gave me a lot of insight into how much our anticipations of the future end up coloring our everyday lives, our decisions, the ways that we think about other people. And it made me start to think very carefully about what I thought about the end of my life and what I expected in the chronology of the next, let's hope, 40 years. And it made me think, you know, you really need to keep cultivation on your own imagination and sort of keep track of what your imagination is feeding you, because even just the sort of most abstract, least cared for imagination, like products, like about your death or about the deaths of your loved ones, can really change how you think and what you are willing to do and what you aren't willing to do.
Can you say more about mm-hmm. that, Ellen? Because there seems to be a lot behind that.
So I'm not an ethicist and I'm not a person who has formally studied ethics, but a lot of what ended up happening in the thought around this book was I realized that even those things that we imagine, not with much care, but just, you know, we have pictures or stereotypes or kind of vague ideas of what will happen to us or what will happen to other people, those things, even though we don't construct them on purpose and we maybe don't construct them for a specific reason, they do end up turning and shaping the way that we think about other people and what we're willing to do for other people and sometimes to other people.
And you're talking now specifically about imagining your death or what happens at the moment of death or right after.
Right. And for both, I think, contemporary people and ancient people, though I realize I'm a historian of the ancient world. So what I'm qualified to talk about are the time period that I study, the people in the time period that I study. But it was really hard, especially during the latter part of the writing of this book, say over the last 3 or 4 years, to not consistently think about the contemporary world, how the products of our imagination in the contemporary world really do affect how we act with other people who are around us every day and to whom we have ethical and moral commitments that we can either acknowledge or let wither based on what we think will happen to them in the future. So, you know, let's think about, you know, you and I are friends. We know each other. I think we're going to be
full
friends.
Disclosure.
Right, indeed. I know T. I think we're going to live in the same town and know each other for a very long time. And so I feel responsible to you in a way that perhaps when I imagine another person and I think, oh gosh, I won't know them for a long time. They're not a part of my life. Or, you know, they're on some other path that isn't like mine. I can very quickly think, I don't have a responsibility to that person. When oftentimes I think you do have a responsibility to all the people around you, especially if you think about our political commitments to one another. I don't want to bring up the word our national commitments to one another, but I really do aspire to that kind of level of care.
As citizens
to the people. Yeah,
in a community.
Exactly. I feel like that word citizen has gotten sometimes it feels a little cheap, or it feels like a little, like it's just what you citizens of the world or American people. But like, there's a part of me that really does believe that we're in this together and we have a commitment, or should have a commitment, to care to one another. But we think about the futures of the people around us very differently based on the assumptions that we have for what's going to happen to them. So that, I mean, this is me all going way out of my lane as a person who studies the ancient world, but that was really what was behind a lot of my thinking, was I don't have the chops or the expertise to make a comment about contemporary society and our ethical reasoning and or lack of ethical reasoning in contemporary society. But I can illuminate that in the ancient world and sort of leave my reader the space to make that connection.
Well, and so hence its consequences in the subtitle, Imagine Death and Its Consequences in Late Ancient Christianity. It's consequences in that time period, but thereafter as well. Like, how is it informed how we see Christianity, or how Christianity impacts our nation,
right?
For example,
right.
I was surprised reading parts of the book, Ellen, that where I thought there were things that I hadn't thought of from my own Catholic upbringing, mm-hmm. like this past training or conditioning or the stories that I heard over and over as a child, and seeing how some of them I didn't even realize, oh, this imagine death was part of the story from the very beginning. Because of the crucifixion, and so it was interesting to see how at this certain time, which you write about and which you have made discoveries and new thought about, is impacting, I don't know how people thought about death. It wasn't just for salvation anymore.
Right.
Not to put it too flippantly, but yeah.
What I found so fascinating was that the people who invented this way of emphasized this way of thinking about death in the time period that I study didn't necessarily introduce that as a way to start moving others around and sort of moving the motivations of others. You know, they might have just thought, oh, this is a way to preach a sermon. This is a way to talk to people about death. But I think once you introduce a product of the imagination that's so sticky and salient, it's going to start to do things in the way that people think about the world and they think about one another that you can't really predict. And so I think, I mean, this book is in a certain way an intellectual history, right? It's about ideas and anticipations. It's not about material culture or about changes in ritual or anything like that. But I think intellectual history can be a genre of writing that really points out to us that sometimes the concepts that we hold and the things that we work up in our imagination are almost more powerful than the structures that are around us or the physical world that we live in, because they can get us to do some very intense things and they can have unpredicted consequences. I mean, when I thought about death and its consequences, none of the things at the end of the book are things that I think the writers I explored at the beginning of the book thought, gosh, this is where this will head. And yet that's what happened.
And how part of these ideas, I think from reading your book, but correct me if I'm wrong, were instrumental in how potentially the Christianity took over from the Roman Empire and sort of had a domination beyond that.
One part of the story of how Christianity came to be such an important and, again, dominant part of late ancient culture is, you know, the money that got spent, the physical spaces that were created, the art that was created. So all of this tangible stuff. But another part of the story was the kind of mental space that it took up and it made demands to take up.
And so thinking of this mental space and also that the epic, like stories,
right,
and how the stories are key for the imagination. Can you talk a little bit about the epigram you chose for the book before we go to break?
Sure. This is two lines from a poem by local poet Raymond McDaniel. Shout out to Ray, friend of the show. And it's from a poem called The Concealed, which first drew my attention because it's about a father warning a couple of children not to meow at cats because they don't know what they're saying in the cat language. But the first two lines of the poem were perfect because they signaled, at least for me, that the book that I wrote was a story that I chose. It was not the only story. But he says, to express an essence of the dead to the living takes storytelling. And the story I like best to tell is this. And it ends, that second line ends with a colon, which I just thought was beautiful because it is an opening to the rest of the story that I happen to tell in this book. But again, that's not the only one that could be told. I like to think of monographs that I write as a set of choices that are, yes, defensible and grounded in evidence about the ancient world, but they're also, again, elections. They're things that I've chosen to put together that don't necessarily have to be that way. I like the idea that there's some fabrication or some fiction in it.
Today on the program, Ellen Muehlberger is here. Moment of Reckoning, Imagine Death and Its Consequences in Late Ancient Christianity, out now with Oxford University Press. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Steph and Gina behind the glass. We'll be back.
I see somebody dropped a nickel on a star just east of Wilcox on the boulevard, shining some famous dead man's name with my paces, preaching my heart out in the marketplace of faces. There is a better way to live. So goes the speech that I will give. I'll turn it up if I feel. God is to hear. There's one less day until the kingdom is here. And I lay my soul.
Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today on the program, Ellen Muehlberger is here. Moment of Reckoning. Imagine Death and Its Consequences in Late Ancient Christianity. Ellen, thanks for picking the songs for today's program.
Hooray! That last song was Amy Ray singing. You probably recognized her voice as one of Indigo Girls, and that was with her group, like a group of Atlanta-based musicians called the New Mongrels, who put out several different discs. They're also, as a collective, people who redid a group, sort of group record of Jesus Christ Superstar, which is really great.
Thanks for choosing the songs for today, because you were choosing with a theme in mind.
Indeed. This last song was about a preacher who works on Hollywood, the Walk of Stars. And part of the book is dedicated to reconstructing how much work ancient preachers did to make their audiences visualize death and to sort of work the imagination of people that they only had the tool of their voice to work with.
And so this connects very clearly to some of the work of Moment of Reckoning,
mm-hmm.
And late ancient Christianity.
I mean, if you think about what a preacher has to do, whether this is a person from the ancient world or the contemporary world, mostly what they have is their voice. You may or may not be seeing them. You may be listening to them on a radio or a cassette tape, but they have their voice and they need...
I love that you just said cassette tape. Sorry. Don't lose your train of thought.
That's right. Well, this is the thing is like cassette tapes, you know, they still work and they still circulate. You know, people listen to a lot of preachers on tape. You can, as a preacher, induce all kinds of visualization in a listener if you're skilled at it. And if you use all the persons and voices that you have available to you, if you switch back and forth between imperative mood and descriptive mood, like one single person who's good at this can be almost the equivalent of a virtual reality experience. You know, you're not seeing things in front of you and you're not hearing and the seat's not shaking, but you can be brought to imagine all of those things. And the preachers that I talk about in the book would often do that by describing death. You know, I could tell you, T, your death is, you know, death in general is terrifying. It's going to be painful and awful and you're going to be regretful. Or I could...
Thanks, Ellen.
Sorry, right?
You heard it here, folks.
Like I said, it's a dark topic. Or I could slowly walk you into that experience and get you to imagine what that would be like by using second person, by...
But also bringing someone to the same terrifying
realizations.
Right, right. So once I do that as a preacher, then you've had a bit of an experience of what that will be like.
An experience.
Yeah. And now you have that to carry around with you. And, you know, if I tell you as a preacher to do this, you can use that as a sort of lens to view your own behavior. Which, you know, in our culture, we do this all the time. We've kind of privileged the person who is terminally ill but has a message for us. So there's lots of different versions of that. When, to go back to the 80s with cassette tapes, there was, you know, Dying Young was a movie. Dead Poets Society was a movie that did this. More recently, there's a physics lecturer who was terminally ill but recorded a lecture about the things that he learned about life. It got very popular. I think his name was Randy Pausch. But we have this thing where we think that people who know that they're dying yet are not yet dead have some sort of extra wisdom. And ancient preachers were trying to get people to imagine that point of their life and then to reason about their behavior based on that point rather than what you want now. I mean,
right. It's like at some point you're meant to have this other kind of understanding in those moments.
Right.
Which is part of the realization I had that, oh, I had that idea of it. Even though I don't know where that came from.
Yeah. And that is now just a part of our culture, but it was something that was relatively new in the time period that I'm writing about, because Christians for a long time, like the first couple of centuries of Christianity, when they, at least what we have in writing, what they wrote about death was, this world is tough and death will be a liberation.
A release, yeah.
Or you'll finally no longer be in pain, or this will be the beginning of a moment of time where you wait and then you are resurrected joyously. So there wasn't really the sense that this was a rough or difficult or torturous thing that you had to go through. It was actually a release of sorts. This was the things that I write about in the book is when it changed, or when we can see it changing. And it became very dark and very difficult. I have a little passage of a sermon if you want me to read it.
That would be great.
And
yes.
What I want.
And why? Why do you think that this was the turn that the preachers started taking?
I have a whole theory about that, actually. But let me read this little piece to you first, and then I'll give you my theory about what happened. So this is by a preacher who is from late antiquity. His name is Jacob of Sarug. He wrote in Syriac. And I chose him specifically to read because he doesn't get read a lot. You know, there's lots of people that you might have heard of, like Augustine or John Chrysostom, who feature in the book. But this is a guy who I thought, gosh, he needs a little more attention. So this isn't a sermon that he delivered. And part of what I want you to notice is that it's all taking place in second person. So as you hear this, think of yourself sitting and listening to somebody saying this to you. This is about the separation of the body and the soul at the end of life. He says, "Say goodbye to the pleasant house in which you grew strong. Say goodbye to the feet that ran swiftly and that death has now gathered into Sheol under dust. Goodbye to the limbs that were like pillars. They wandered and bore the soul and the body during the span of your life. Goodbye to the hands that gave and received. Behold, they rest on the chest today in the abode of the departed. Goodbye to the mouth that spoke all wise things. For behold, now it is blocked, full of putrid filth, according to the way of the life of the dead. Goodbye to the eyes that gaze desirously, because now they contain nests for the maggot and the worm. Goodbye to the nostrils that once drew in all fragrances. For behold, they are blocked up with shortness of breath and are cast down to the way of life in Sheol." And if you haven't heard the term Sheol before, that's what this author calls kind of the shadowy place that dead people live. Not exactly hell, but not a place that you're really excited to go.
And not exactly the post-mortal.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly. So this piece, if you notice,
it's suffocating.
It is suffocating, quite literally. You know, your breath is blocked up. You're no longer using your hands. And you'll notice it goes from bottom to top. So feet, limbs, hands, mouth, eyes, and then the very last thing that you can breathe through, your nostrils. And those are blocked too. And all of this is happening. You're hearing, say goodbye, say goodbye, say goodbye. It's an effect. You know, if I were a preacher now, I'd probably have access to like beautiful AV equipment and a sound system and all this kind of stuff. But Jacob had his voice and his rhetorical ability. And what he did was he induced someone to imagine sort of a reverse body scan. He induced them to think about, from the top, from the bottom to the top, here is how I'm going to die, and here's how each part of my body is going to feel when I die. Like I said, it's dark. So what is your theory on why this started happening?
Well, because it sounds like it earlier in the book than where we are right now.
Yeah.
There were moments where when you, like with Constantine, where his story almost was rewritten, it seems like some years after his death, to show him as a Christian.
Right. Right.
Why were they changing or twisting the feeling of the stories of the deathbed and thereafter?
I had a couple of different ideas about that. The first, the one that has to do with Constantine and the depiction of his death, this is something I treat in an earlier chapter of the book, was that Christians at the beginning of the 4th century, all of a sudden were in a new and different world where their religion was no longer criminalized. And they had access to power and money that they hadn't had before. And even with that, some things turned out the direction they wanted it to, and sometimes it didn't turn out that way. And so when you're looking at the world around you and you think, it's not turning out how I want, you need an alternate system for figuring out what's right and what's wrong. We could be in a situation like this right now. American politics has often thought, well, you know, we have this contest and we want to elect a leader, and then we all elect the best possible leader. I think many people think, how could that? I mean, we're still living, many of us are still living in the aftermath of, how could that possibly have happened? How can we have gotten to this place? We need some sort of alternate explanation for how this happened, even though I think many people in the United States think, well, it happened because he turned out to be the best leader. So when the world is not going the direction you want it to, you need an alternate source of confirmation of how you are and whether you're doing right or you're not doing right. And Christian writers, with all the sort of support and financial and political heft in the world behind them, still needed some other way to confirm the world around them. And the easiest way to do that was to talk about the deaths of other people as being a sign of their morality. So that was thing one. The other thing, and this is getting back to an earlier question, is you had asked, why did preachers start talking this way about death? And what I noticed was that they used second person and first person a lot. So there are other sermons in the book that will say things like, I am the dying person and I feel these things, which is a weird choice for people who have been using a lot of third person the whole time. And I noticed that across geographic areas, across different kinds of languages, preachers consistently did this. And what they all had in common was not Christianity or not some common literature they had all produced together, but rather the system of learning how to write as a man in the ancient world. So, I mean, we both have taught writing in the past. It's almost the equivalent of, you know, you meet somebody in their first year at University of Michigan, you ask them to write a 2-page essay, and what they're going to write for you is a 5-paragraph essay because that's what they've learned to write in high school. These men all learned to write in a certain way, and part of that training was thinking about tragic circumstances by adopting the first-person voice of the person in the tragic circumstance and then exploring that. So, of course, when it comes to preaching about death...
Like with the death of Socrates.
Right, right.
You write about in the book.
They think, well, here's a tragic circumstance. It's difficult. How do I talk about it? Well, I adopt that voice, or I get my audience to start thinking about it in a way that's first-person based. So instead of telling you death is hard and you should think about it differently, I'm going to try to induce the experience of that for you, because that's the way I've learned how to reason about tragedy in general. Yeah. Like I said, it was dark.
I was just thinking, I wonder if we should have had some sort of like warning before, especially before the sermon.
Yeah. Right. Right.
But no, that's the thing. This is, it's all part of the reckoning with life and being. And like you said, it seems like writing this book really changed how you saw your present moment and relationships with others, as well as your own.
It was clarifying. It was absolutely clarifying. Yeah. And it made me concerned for the way that we think about the futures of other people. And it made me think that in general, future conceptualization or future casting, I don't know what to call it, but like that is a political action that we all do. We all imagine the futures of everybody around us at all times. You know, you see somebody on the bus and you think, oh, there's a freshman, or, oh, there's a woman who's at the end of her career, or, oh, there's a person who's like going to the grocery store. And we imagine what all these people are going to be doing just based on the sight of them. And in American politics, we do that based on oftentimes how they look and what social category we put them in. And imagining different futures for different people really starts to affect how we allocate resources, how we allocate our emotions and our time to other people. It changed me. It really changed me, and it made me aware and sort of intensely concerned about the role of the imagination of the future in American politics.
Let's take a short break.
Right.
And then more when we come back. And we'll hear, and Ellen, will you read a section of
Sure.
Moment of Reckoning, Imagine Death and Its Consequences in Late Ancient Christianity. Today on Living Writers, Ellen Muehlberger is here in the studio. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be right back. Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, so glad you did. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today, Ellen Muehlberger is here. The book, Moment of Reckoning, Imagine Death and Its Consequences in Late Ancient Christianity. Ellen, you know what? Before we go any further,
yeah.
I forgot one of the things I wanted to talk with you about, because the joy and fearsomeness of this cover.
Oh.
And do you mind just telling us briefly before we get back to talking about the inside the book, like how you found the cover picture and what it is?
It's a little tiny object in the Detroit Institute of Arts, actually. And
and you saw it there.
I recently was there. Like, I was there, like, I don't know, 5 days ago, last Friday. And it had been on exhibit. So it has gone to like Bowdoin College. It's gone to several other places as part of a traveling exhibit, but it was back in the case when we went there on Friday. And I just totally fangirled. I was like, oh, I have to take a picture. And you know, it's big on the front of the cover. And for people who haven't seen the cover, it's a piece of ivory. You're looking at it at the side, and it is a two-faced person. One face, they have their eyes closed, and they have a little sort of cloth over their head. So perhaps it looks a little bit like a dead person. The other face is a skull that has salamanders and worms crawling all over it. And again, on the cover, it's the full cover. That image is almost the entirety of the cover of the book. So it looks very big, but in reality, it's smaller than the palm of my hand. It's tiny.
And you can actually, folks can see pictures of the cover. And actually this, and what is the object called?
I don't know what it's called. It's the biggest bead on a rosary. So, it was part of a rosary carved out of ivory in 14th or 15th century France. The museum placard has the name of a possible artist, although I do not remember the name, and I can't pronounce French anyway, so I probably wouldn't be able to pronounce it, but it is the biggest bead at the end of a rosary. So it's meant during prayer to remind you that all this praying that you're doing in this body is eventually going to be a thing that salamanders and worms crawl through.
Yep. And so folks can see this if they go to, because you've got it on your Twitter
right.
Account and at the Living Writers Instagram, you can check out the cover.
Yeah.
and or go to the DIA.
Go to the DIA.
If you're near the Detroit Institute of Art.
I mean, that is an amazing museum. And I think if you have not been there, you need to go. You can see this little tiny piece, but you can also see a million other beautiful things.
So, Ellen, let's talk. Let's get back to Moment of Reckoning. Mm-hmm. And maybe actually, do you mind reading the section that you picked for today?
Yeah, sure.
And I know there's some setup for it.
I mean, before the break, we were talking about the role of anticipation and the products of the imagination that we make for other people. So when I look at someone, I think, oh, there's their future, or I can see what's going to happen to them in the future. And this was a realization. I did not start the book thinking I was going to end up writing about anticipation as a piece.
Well, because you started thinking that you had an interest in death. Like it was something that, right, that was like this very large, giant sort of idea. And then you started following it to find your way.
I mean, it got narrower very quickly once I realized that I was not skilled enough to talk about, you know, funerary art and relics. I was not skilled enough to talk about funeral rituals or sort of graveside rituals. There were people in my field who are experts about that. And I thought, that's not my lane. You know, I just don't know about that. I mean, I know about it, but I don't know about it in the way that you need to write about it this way. But very quickly, I thought, I do know about what people imagine and imaginary things. And that's sort of what I write about. And you might think being a historian is about discovering the past. And you wouldn't really think, oh, a historian has to think about also the future that's held in mind in the past. But that is precisely what this is about, is thinking about the time period that I study and those people and what they thought of in their own future. Whether it comes to pass or not really influences their life. And it turned into a thing. I don't know that this is a thing that exists yet, and probably it does somewhere, but like, the study of anticipation or the study of futures held in mind can really quickly lead to ethical choices and the examination of ethical choices. So this piece that I'm going to read to you summarizes that in a way and sort of explains the implications of thinking about the future so much. So this comes at the end of a chapter where I've explained that the way that preachers set up death as a moment of reckoning eventually becomes the foundation for Christians to reason that it's okay to use compulsion, like physical violence against other Christians when they don't agree, which is a very sort of strange part of late ancient Christianity. You'd think this is a religion based around a person who Christians think unjustly executed. So how could they start to justify using the threat of force against other people? But they do very quickly. And so I thought, all right, these two things are linked. Thinking about somebody else's future allows you to make a kind of intervention. So that's what this little piece is describing. I say, anticipating a future where everyone has already come to realize the truth is a significant political tool. It helps to manage present difference by minimizing that difference as a temporary feature. It creates an implicit draw toward a majority that does not yet exist. And because it resides in the future, it is unfalsifiable, inexhaustible. Much better to reason about dissidents' future selves, who are removed beyond the act of compulsion that brings them to write, and are, at that point, effusive in their gratitude for having been forced to become right. It's a short step, then, to seeing religious deviance as people needing correction. The use of force to compel religious opponents to one side seems so grave a decision that it should have originated from meticulous consideration or principled and reasoned thought. But justifications for force in late antiquity developed not from principles, but from images, imagined scenarios, and projections of the future. Late ancient Christians learned how to anticipate death in a particular way. They nursed the habit of imagining it that way, and it changed what they thought of human beings. That, in turn, changed what they thought it right and even necessary to do to other human beings. The products of our imagination can be magnetic. They inexorably pull us to accept new positions and actions, especially when they depict for us a difficult and frightening future. Based on the scenarios that we create and we nurse, we rationalize what we will do, what resources we will spend or hold back, what empathies we will engage or tamp down, which principles we will hold to and which ones we will abandon. The most striking part of late ancient Christianity, namely its acceptance of the use of force in religious conflict, was eased by the habits of thought inspired by anticipating death in a particular way. What do we create now, and what do we afford now by the things that we anticipate for our futures and for the futures of others?
Thanks, Ellen.
Yeah.
And so that's you asking a direct question, inviting the reader to think beyond the page, beyond the moment.
Right.
You
know, I'm working with a material that I know well, and I saw a certain relationship between the conceptualizations that preachers created and taught people to continuously return to, and the way that they then felt justified in calling on, calling on force in situations of conflict rather than calling on rationality or discussion or debate. And when I saw those two things linked, I thought, gosh, this cannot be the only place that this has happened, for several reasons. First, you know, humans are humans. But second, Christianity was such a dominant culture in so many places, and this is its basis. You know, late antiquity is a place where a lot of Christian tradition gets inaugurated. So I thought this must be the case in other situations. I just don't have the expertise to actually make that case, but I think other people do.
And when you, and what do you, what are you also thinking, Ellen, like for the reader to map on to the present moment? Because you've talked about your experience, how writing this book has changed you, and how, like, relationally, politically. Do you think that's something that the reader, like, ends up, like, the experience of the book? Because we've been talking about the experience of the sermon. So a reader comes through this book, Moment of Reckoning, with you, guided by you.
You know, I think somebody reading this book will learn a lot about early Christianity, but what I hope might happen to them as a consumer of contemporary culture is that they would realize that the things that we think of as not serious or maybe throwaway, you know, like cartoons and movies, especially like, you know, popular culture movies or songs, you know, things that aren't intellectual, quote unquote, actually end up shaping a lot of our thinking. In this case, most of the book, I deal with things that are not high intellectual culture for the ancient world. They're not philosophical treatises. They're not highly reasoned arguments. They're dreams and visions and other kinds of genres that have gotten dismissed as fantastical or magical or, you know, too religious to really be the source of intellectual history. And I think that somebody reading this book and then looking at the kinds of input that you're getting from the world around you, whether, you know, what you're reading or what you're looking at, high culture and low culture really do shape us whether we want them to or not. And I think people are very quick to think, ah, well, what we need to think about is the things that look like argumentation or the things that look like rhetorical persuasion. And an image can be persuasive and deeply affecting when it doesn't, I mean, something as simple as like a cartoon can change how you think about the world. Let me give an example. So much of the theme today has been, you know, we're children of the 80s, so let's talk about the Smurfs. To get very sort of Saturday morning about it. If you remember the Smurfs, there are multiple Smurfs. They're all boys except for one. There's a girl, Smurfette. She has a different name. She has a different body, so she's curvy in a way that, like, there are standard Smurf bodies and then there's the girl body. And there's only one of her, right?
So she could wear the astronaut suit.
Right. That's right. See, this is where we're headed, is the astronaut suit. They'd only imagine one. But if you think, you know, just a kid watching Saturday morning cartoons, you know, boy or girl, whatever, what you learn is that the world is set up for normal, which is boy, and there's only one girl, and that's what's different about her. The same thing happens with the Disney character. So you think Mickey and Minnie, but Pluto, Daffy, like the entire Disney lineup is all boys except for Minnie, who's a variation on Mickey, and you can tell because she's curvy and weird. Those are, you know, those are not moments where we think, oh gosh, this is really going to change what we think about who belongs at the table when we're making high policy decisions or who belongs on the list of best writers. But those things are all linked. And I, you know, several of my colleagues make this kind of argument over and over and over again, like different pieces of culture change how we think. But I think a reader coming out of this book might imagine, oh, right, I need to be careful about what I allow to determine my thoughts about the future not just of myself, but of other people.
So in being aware of the stories that not only that we tell about ourselves, but that we find ourselves starting to tell about others, mm-hmm. like even just like on the spur of the moment, like on the bus, as you were saying earlier, Ellen, and the stories that are around us that we allow ourselves to absorb somehow.
Yeah. Even when they're not very clearly pitched at changing our minds about things, almost more importantly, when they're not very clearly pitched at changing, because I think, you know, we as consumers of culture can see when somebody's trying to convince us of something. We don't see nearly as easily when something's depicted as normal and natural, when it's actually highly selective and highly narrowly available only to certain people.
Let's take a short break.
Sure.
And then when we come back, more today with Ellen Muehlberger. Moment of Reckoning, Imagine Death and Its Consequences in Late Ancient Christianity, out with Oxford University Press. Thanks, Oxford, for sending the book, by the way. Thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back with more with Ellen Muehlberger. Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel today. Ellen Muehlberger is here. Moment of Reckoning. Imagine Death and Its Consequences in Late Ancient Christianity. Out this month with Oxford University Press. That song just like totally brought the mood
up. I love them so much. That album came out actually while I was home writing this book for a year.
Really?
Yeah. It was great.
Oh, so that it has like a special relationship with
it
this
really
book.
Does. Yep.
Oh, that's excellent, Ellen. So yeah, so writing Moment of Reckoning. Let's talk about the process. You mentioned earlier that it was arduous and that the ideas within the book were dark, and it is an intense read and valuable. You mentioned also choosing Jacob's sermon, the Syriac, to read because it was one that was not a voice. You don't usually hear his voice.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk a little bit about how you did the reading, the research,
finding
the pieces that you put together for Moment of Reckoning?
Well, the word canon, you know, when we talk about the canon or canonical things, the word canon actually comes from my time period. It's a measuring stick or a thing that you, a standard against which you measure things. In early Christianity, as a culture, had an idea of there being a canon of literature. But also, people who study early Christianity have long had an idea that there's a canon of the greatest hits. You know, sort of the people that you should read because they are important. And that gets mixed up with they're holy, and also it gets mixed up with they write in the right languages. So a book like this gave me a chance to work with literatures that don't often get put alongside these other writers that maybe listeners have heard of. So like Augustine is someone that, you know, if you haven't heard of anybody else, you've heard of him. And he's written a lot about death and he features in the book, but you maybe haven't heard of Jacob of Sarug, or maybe, I mean, you may not have heard of Shenouda, who's an Egyptian writer, but these were men who were as important in their time as Augustine. And the tradition that stands between me and the people that I study tells me that Augustine is far more important. But if I'm interested in understanding that time period, then I need to think of all these writers as, equal sources of evidence. And so part of the fun of the book was getting to put them in conversation, and without necessarily flagging it so much. I do a little bit in the introduction, but mostly I'm just sticking them together in the chapter and saying to the reader implicitly, look, you're going to read these guys, whether you've heard of them or not before. And that felt, that's something that I think I'm proud to do and I feel good about doing in the book. But I should say, a lot of the time spent of this book was spent on leave. I got very, very lucky, and both the American Council of Learned Societies and the National Endowment for Humanities supported the writing of this book. And I don't imagine that that will ever happen again in my lifetime, like getting that much time to just work on this. I feel like a lot of the development that happened over the course of writing it, moving it from just a catalog of ideas or a catalog of sources to a book that actually makes an argument about ethics, that's something that happened because I had the time.
Well, and you also learned Armenian.
Well, that...
I mean, just as an aside.
That also happened
for four pages,
right,
that you found in your research, and you didn't want to read them in the one French translation that was available.
That's exactly right. So I had long had, you know, I mean, I know several ancient languages, and when you know several of them, the number that you want to know is always N plus one. So you always want to know the next one, and you're always sort of collecting ideas for what's going to justify me studying this next thing. And I had a list of texts that I wanted to read in Armenian, and I just had never gotten to it. And then a key piece of evidence about how rhetoric forms a person and how it ends up showing up in later writings, which is the foundation of my idea that all these men who are preaching these sermons learned how to write a certain way about tragedy and then spoke to their audiences a certain way about tragedy. That was only in Armenian. And I was like, oh, I've got to do this. And luckily I had a friend, his name is Adam Becker. He teaches at NYU, who I was Skyping back and forth with at the time we were reading Syriac together. And he too had a list, you know, he was like, I got to learn Armenian. I got to learn it. And finally I was like, let's just do this. Let's just, you know, we're both good language students. Let's just get together, go through the textbook. And I'm not saying that I'm great at Armenian. I'm really, really not. But I knew enough, or I knew it well enough to read that text and see its implications and things that weren't available really in the French translation. So I thought, all right, here it is.
And with that part of the process, with you having your mind sort of learning and in some ways playing with this, like the language to learn it, I imagine.
Yeah.
Did that also help with other parts that you were able to move forward in the book, that because sometimes there are parts that are more of a slog or so, or we're, I don't know.
Well, I mean,
maybe not with Moment of Reckoning.
At least for me, in the writing process consists of different registers of tasks. There's invention and sort of thinking about things that you haven't thought about before and kind of trying to articulate new ideas. And then, you know, that's one end of the spectrum. And maybe at the other end of the spectrum, the far more tasky part is like proofreading and following up footnotes and that sort of stuff. And I find I only have limited energy for that highest order of task because, you know, I just can't do that for very long. The ideas don't get any better. And so I have to parse myself out tasks at the other end of the far more sort of quotidian or like do this part of the spectrum so that I can have the energy to do the other thing again. I think that balancing the register of tasks is part of the secret. Like, you can only spend so much time coming up with new composition, and you have to parse that out very carefully and protect that time, but then fill in the rest of it with other things that you need to do. There's a lot that goes into the writing of a book that is more than just the composition of it. There's a lot of translation. There's a lot of looking stuff up. There's asking friends to comment on things. There's commenting on friends' things so that you can have a well of people who will eventually comment on your draft. You know, I mean, writers know this, but I'm just articulating it out loud that there's the composition part, the actual new exposition of ideas is such a small fraction of what actually goes on the whole time. But it's the hardest. It's the most taxing.
And it seems like you are a firm believer in writing is thinking.
Absolutely. I really, it's a cliche to say I don't know what I think until I write it down, but I write out longhand. I mean, I've never yet learned how to compose with a screen in front of me. It's just not, I've tried a lot, but it just doesn't work the same way for me. So I write out longhand. And oftentimes when I'm writing out longhand, my brain will be a sentence ahead and it will be composing things or popping up new ideas that if I don't capture them that moment, they will just be gone. And there's often, there are new ramifications or new paths to follow that weren't available to me before I started handwriting out whatever paragraph or whatever sort of free write that I'm doing.
And so that's so key for your invention.
It is the only way I know how to do it. I mean, not only is it key, it is the solo way that I know how to get there. Other writers have other processes, I'm sure, and other ways of getting to new conceptualizations are available to people, but that is the only thing that I have ever found that works for me.
So I should say that while I was researching you, Ellen Muehlberger, I saw that you have a talk on YouTube, Fits and Starts.
Yes.
So folks can look that up if they want to know more about maybe working with a longer project, some of your ideas. It's a great talk, Fits and Starts on YouTube.
It was something that was sponsored by the Center for Middle East and North African Studies here. And it was directed at dissertation writers or people who are getting ready to start writing a dissertation. But a dissertation is just a version of a book, right? So if you are thinking about a long book or a series of articles, that was almost more sort of like camp counselor advice for sustaining yourself through something that long.
And it's pretty new. September 2018, I think.
Right, that's
so
right.
So it's, yeah, it's pretty. It's not vintage Ellen. It's new Ellen Muehlberger. So what's the project now, Ellen? What are you? We have just a couple of minutes, but what are you working on?
It's something that got started with this book, actually. And it is about ancient people's interest and fascination with things that turn out to be not what they seem. So one of the texts that I work with for this book was a writing composition exercise that entertains the question, what does the prostitute say when she realizes that she has, and this ancient word, sophrosune, it could be like wisdom or self-determination, which is, you know, it tells you ancient people thought prostitutes did not have that, but what about the paradoxical situation when she does have that? And this was a writing exercise that young men were assigned, you know, like middle school age men or, you know, maybe young teenagers. And it is interesting to me that people thought that was a fascinating moment, that they imagined a woman who is a sex worker doesn't have this thing. What happens when you magically give her this thing that she cannot have based on her social identity? And let's talk about that and imagine how she is not what she seems. And once I articulated that, like the thrill of watching something that's not what it seems, it's just everywhere. Ancient people, especially late ancient people, were just fascinated with, I found this thing. It looks like X, but it is actually Y. Both fascinated in a positive way, like it was pleasurable to them to think about that, but also in a sort of terrified or disparaging way. You know, Christian writers are often like, oh, this person looks like they're a Christian, but they're insufficiently converted. They're still a pagan in secret, and they have a secret room in their house with pagan idol. That's Schnuda. So I thought, all right, there is a book to be written about that theme of the turn between what appears and what seems to be and what the actual thing is. That's as much as I know about it right now, but that's where I'm headed. And I have the next year, actually. So I'm finishing teaching right now, and then I'm off. I'm on leave, thanks to an internal grant from the University of Michigan. I'm on leave for the next year to work on this. So I'm excited about that.
Well, me too now, Ellen. Can't wait. Can't wait. Today on the program, thanks so much, Ellen, for being here.
Thank you for having me. This is a delight.
Ellen Muehlberger, her book, Moment of Reckoning, Imagine Death and Its Consequences in Late Ancient Christianity. Come back anytime, Ellen.
Absolutely. I love living writers.
Thanks to everyone out there for listening. Thanks to Stephanie for being behind the glass and Gina also being behind the glass today. Thanks to Frank Yulee for post-production work. Again, thanks everyone for listening out there. I'm T. Hetzel. Until next time.
3, 4.
The battle's been lost. The war is not won. An adult republic, a bitter refund. Business first, flat earthers licking their wounds. The
verdict is dire, the country's in ruins. Providence bleeds, facing the sun. Where are we left to carry on? Until the day